The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And it has been ages. This is an in-person podcast. I am so thrilled and excited. Taylor Emerson, the vintner for Black Bank Hill Winery, is my guest. For anyone listening, the place is disinfected. Doors and windows are open. We are both double vaccinated. And it's weird. It's weird, Taylor. I feel like I need to say that off the top.
Yeah, we do. We do. But it's also awesome, Matthew. Thank you for having me. As I said, it feels very personal, but real at the same time. It's great.
Well, it's just weird. We haven't been around that many people.
And coming up to your house and knocking on the door was like, we haven't met yet.
Yeah.
This is personal. It's great.
No worries. Listen, thank you for taking the time. Thank you for coming. You've brought two of your wines. We'll taste them in a little bit.
Wonderful.
But let's first go back to your, even before your first vintage. I'd love to hear a little bit about your story that brought you towards your wine, Black Bank Hill.
Well, everybody has a wine story. Often they're somewhat similar, but I fell in love with wine, I guess, in my mid-30s. Mm-hmm. And, not dissimilar from your story, as I was asking about, sort of had a few of those experiences that were sort of transportational and said, okay, this is not your everyday or ordinary beverage. I'm not just drinking this for the alcohol anymore. There's something else going on. The alcohol was fun, and we all probably drank too much as youngsters, but now we're going, it was a food experience. And what I realized was it connected me with what I'd had an interest in since I was very young, which was food and cooking. And, you know, my grandparents would give me cookbooks and stuff like that, like how to make a chocolate chip cookie kind of thing as an 8-year-old for fun. Yeah. Because I was always trying to figure out how is that made. And even I'll remember, this is a bit of a weird story, but I remember my dad was into wine. And when I was a kid, this was my early teens, we went down to Napa Valley and we went to Domaine Chandon.
Yep.
With the sparkling house. And I remember that vividly. It was one of my first wine tours. And the guy was talked about the fermentations and the malolactic fermentation. I was sitting there. I was like, I got to know how that works. It was just one of the, but at that time it was purely a cooking idea.
Yeah.
You know, how do you go from a juice to a flavor? And I was just always kind of there. So when I hit that wine experience, I was like, okay, this brings a lot of pieces together.
All right, question. When you're at Chandon, at any point did you call it champagne? And then everyone came and swiftly corrected you?
I can't remember. I have no idea. I was probably thinking it was champagne because the idea of the appellation system is still befuddles people. It's amazing. And you still have people talking about, you know, port wines or port style wines or sherries and stuff. And you're like, got to get away from that.
Did you have a wine in particular? Was there a moment when, I mean, obviously, if you love food, it's such an easy transition to go from food to loving wine.
Yeah.
Was there a bottle? Was there a moment?
Yeah, there was a couple. There's All a right. few always. You know what? One of the first ones I'll tell you was an Ontario wine from Malivoire, a Gewürztraminer, 2004. Mm-hmm. And it was context. I was with my in-laws. They're both great cooks. And they're of Indian origin and descent. Yeah. And they're great. They make a great Indian meal. So I'm sitting down for one of my first kind of big Indian meals at their house. And they pair Gewürztraminer with Indian food almost all the time.
Yeah.
Great Alsatian ones. But that night it was a Malivoire. And it was partially the food and partially the wine. And the combination was like 1 + 1 = 5.
Yeah.
Another one was 2001 Brunello. That, you know, when I started going through, you start like a lot of us in Ontario, you go through the LCBO books and you're scouring the releases and picked up a nice one. And it was just like, wow, different level.
But yours is, by the way, this is the first time where it was a Gewürztraminer.
Yeah.
B, it was an Ontario Gewürztraminer.
Yeah.
And it's such the stereotype, but it is true. Like when you start learning about food and wine pairings and when you talk about like Indian foods and the variety of flavors and spices, they always say, oh, well, you know, sometimes a Riesling, but often Gewürztraminer goes well with it. And it just does. It's like, I will sometimes push back against some of the traditional food to wine pairings. You know, the rules, if you like the food, if you like the wine, they should match. But there are certain things, like don't drink Cabernet with a seafood tower. And a classic one is a Gewürz with Indian. That's a classic combo.
It's the spiciness and the aromatics of it and the complex in this breadth of the aromatics in the wine and the breadth of the aromatics in the food. And the fact that they do pair up so well is amazing. Mm-hmm. And a little bit of residual sugar, I got to say, helps the wine, helps bring out the flavors. It's a bit like salt on a steak, I often say. It's kind of like... It can be lovely dry, but it's much more similar to a lot of other wines. Gewürztraminer is a tough... I mean, Ontario, I mean, they make less of it, they sell less of it, and it's a bit sad because we...
It's a hard sell.
We make a damn good Gewürztraminer, and it's a weird word, it's a weird name, but people just don't... It takes convincing to get into the spice of it, and it's like, wow, just open... Sometimes I say you got to drink wine with your heart more than your mind. It's sort of like, don't forget about the think... Don't think so much, just open yourself up to it. It's an amazing wine.
And it's a tough sell to try to sell to restaurants for their by the glass program.
Yeah,
you know it's gonna be your Pinot Grigios, your Chardonnays. You know, maybe you get one other varietal, but like a Riesling or the really adventurous, I'm a Gruner. But
yeah,
the Gewürztraminer, and I get it. That's hard for the restaurant manager to be like, listen, I love this wine. 2 years from now, I'm gonna he or she's gonna tell you I've got still 11 of the 12 bottles because it's not moving.
It's just a weird thing. I think the name has a lot to do with it. Mm-hmm. The wine is just, to me, it's just delicious. It's almost, I might be putting myself out in the extreme end of the spectrum, but it seems like it's just openly delicious, especially with a little bit, you know, 12, 15 grams of residual sugar just balancing out. It's not a high acidity wine at all, but it just sort of gets in there, balances out the acidity. What's not to like? I don't get it.
Yeah. So then you... you're in Napa. You're trying these a great Gewürztraminer with Indian. You're having an 01 Brunello.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that jump go to, okay, it's time for me to open up and to start, you know, making my own wine with, and again, the winery is Black Bank Hill.
Yeah. Great question. I mean, the context of a lot of those wines is I was living in Toronto, Ontario, going to Niagara a fair bit. So Ontario was kind of a backstop, was always part of that wine journey and learning more and more about Ontario. But Ontario is a bit of a place that I know why its development in sort of in the world terms has been, I would call it a little bit slow, not only because Canadians are a bit humble and we're not, you know, huge self-promoters, but the wines are not showy, flashy wines. You sort of have to sit with them and over time, you'll develop a relationship with them and realize that they do have something distinct and interesting and individual to say. But they're not going to jump out and grab you in the crotch of your pants and say, listen to me kind of wines.
Yeah.
But that was always there. And then, you know, my job took me over to...
what was your job?
I was working in media at the Weather Network.
Mm-hmm.
So I was working on the digital platform for many years, for 17 years. It was a great project, great time in my life. We ended up buying a company in Spain, so I was living in Spain for about a year. And then just, you know, deep dive into Spanish wines, which is had become a... And I'd experienced a few of them before I traveled there, but living there was like, okay, another... Not overlooked, because it's one of the, you know, three probably great wine regions, countries of the world, but... And then moved to London. And in London, I went to... the job ended. I ended up going to agricultural school for winemaking, Plumpton College. They have a viticulture and enology program, and that was when I decided to make the big move, switch careers midlife, so to speak. A little cliche, but based on where I was, had to happen at the time.
Yeah.
And I thought, I didn't know I was coming back to Canada, frankly. And we're getting a third of the way through the course the first year, and I'm thinking to myself, the teacher gave us a few good readings. This is... was an interesting moment for me. There, of course, readings on terroir, you know, obviously a central topic to wine and what it means and getting everybody's view on it. And there's a lot of good definitions of it, which makes it an interesting conversation. The more I read about this thing, I said, I have to go do this wine project in Canada. Because at the time I thought I might, be great to do it in Italy or France. You know, we have these dreams, but they just weren't realistic.
Yeah.
First of all, I didn't speak the language well enough. Second of all, you need so much support, and you need people around you, and
you need an infrastructure that also will embrace you.
Yeah,
maybe a little bit trickier if you're the Canadian. Hey guys, I'd like to buy some of your property that's been owned for 4,000 years, and monks tilled the field, and I'd like to make my own wine.
Yeah, all those things were dawning on me. And at the same time, I was learning enough about wine. I said, I'm not going to add anything to the world of wine by trying to make wine in their style and do what's been done, perfected so well for hundreds of years. I'm just not going to move the needle forward or do. And I looked at my home and I said, not only has this place got so much to say that hasn't been said yet, it's got an identity. It's also my identity. It's deep within me and my heart. And I'd rather join that rising tide and move that thing ahead. So glad I did, for many reasons. And the farther I get into it, the more I'm just happy with that direction.
And also in terms of the timing, certainly, I mean, we're not where we want to be, but the acceptance, the popularity of Ontario wine is certainly greater now than when you went over to Spain.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Every year.
Yeah.
The understanding, the popularity, and the quality of the wines, I think you can see noticeable improvements in the sophistication of all the both the growing and the winemaking. Every year, there's just a little notches. And that's because, you know, 25 years or... people date it differently, but whatever, I guess we're talking, early 80s, really.
Yeah.
So let's give it more than 25, but it takes a while. It takes a while.
So then, how, take me through a little of the process. The grapes here for these wines, let's first start with, this is your first vintage, correct?
First vintage.
All right. So how scared, excited are you about all this? This is your first release.
Both scared and excited. I didn't actually even think I'd start making wines in 2018. I just bought the property, 22 acres in Beamsville, in early 17. Mm-hmm. And I spent that summer just sort of throwing out garbage, old farmhouse, old barn, just cleaning stuff up. We took out a road that was going right through where you'd plant the vineyard. And ordering the clones, you know, just planning how big, how many plots, where are we going to put everything? What are we going to order? Which is a sizable little effort in itself to get it. And if you haven't done it before, you don't know whether you're doing a good job at all.
Yeah.
So I'm planting in 18 and I'm talking to the viticulturalist and he's like, yeah, well, we've got some extra grapes and it's a good hot year and the Cabernet Sauvignon is sort of like 2 weeks ahead of where it should be. Why don't you could buy some and make it. I said, that's a great idea, because I was sort of fresh out of winemaking school and I thought I just want to keep my chops up and I'll just make a few barrels and et cetera, et cetera. Just, you know, just get to know the local characteristics. That's really how it happened. And I said, okay, I'm going to throw this on top of my workload just because I kind of feel like I should just get the ball going.
Right.
And it turned out, I got to say, I'm super happy with the results. It turned out better than I expected.
Who's your team? When you decided to start this and buying the property and working the field and all of that, like, I'm curious, who's your team? And was anyone in that we would know in the business was helpful?
So the big part of the team for the first couple of years was Glenn Elgin, Vineyard Management, mm-hmm. Craig and Chris Wismer, mm-hmm. who basically managed the vineyard, which is 90% of the work. Me, I led it in terms of, I'm going to find the property, and I looked at a bunch. This one seemed the right mix of, okay, I can afford it. It's not, it doesn't have a big house on it, and it's below the bench. Mm-hmm. And actually, which I think turned out to be a great decision, just north of King Street, beautiful, warm little pocket where the heat collects. You get a lot of ripening of, you get a lot of red grapes planted on that north side of King Street as you're going along the bench there. And you're sort of a degree and a half warmer than the bench at any given time. So
hence you can attempt the Cabernet.
The Cabernet. These grapes I bought. Mm-hmm. So the vineyard had just been planted. These I bought. These are from 20 Mile Bench predominantly, but Cabernet, the Syrahs, and Syrah I think is a grape that I'm going to be 100% behind. I planted a bit. I want to plant some more. But when you can ripen it, I think it's just a wonderful thing in Niagara and in the escarpment part of Niagara particularly. So looking forward to that. But ripening Cabernet Sauvignon is even harder than Syrah. And we ripened it in, give you an example, on Black Bank Hill Vineyard 2020, I picked the Cabernet Sauvignon in September 29th. I don't think anybody's picked Cabernet in September before. And it was about a week early. It was a little bit early. But when you got that warming, you got 2020, probably the warmest summer I know of.
Yeah, oh no, 2020, it's been talked about a lot.
Right. So ripening Cabernet, when I started and I was picking at grapes, I was going, you know, people say, hey, don't bother with the Cabernet. People are ripping it out.
Mm-hmm.
Ripens every 1 in 4 years. And I said, okay, that's interesting. I still really like it. And I don't need heavy, big wines. And I'm not trying to make Napa Cab. I'm not trying to make Chilean Cab. And I'm not trying to make Bordeaux Cab.
Which would be impossible in this area.
It would be impossible. And anyways, my favorite wines are lighter styled in any case. So this wine that we'll try in a few minutes, I guess, came out. I blended a little bit of Cabernet Franc into it to actually just flesh out a bit of the mid palate because it drank like a Pinot Noir. It came out
really
beautifully light.
Yeah.
Red.
That's crazy.
It was, and it's still put on weight actually since the barrel aging and another, I guess, year in bottle now. It's just starting to sort of flesh out, but it came out super light and I loved it.
So, one more question, then we'll try the 2018, Foxcroft Chardonnay from yep. 20 Mile Bench. So these wines are not from your property, but moving forward, will you be making wines from the land you bought and still doing work with these grape growers? And people should know, you said you got stuff from Wismer. Yeah. The Wismer vineyards are I shouldn't say very well known. That's for the geeks. Are very well, but yeah. it's a great source of high quality grapes.
Absolutely, yeah. Lots of people use them, and they have some great vineyards, both in aspect and positioning, and you know, midway up the bench and stuff. So no, they're established vineyards in Ontario for sure. So 2020, we got our first little harvest,
mm-hmm.
just over 7 tons from the few acres we planted in 18.
Yep.
And that'll grow. As that grows, we'll basically stop buying fruit. Well, right. I mean, the goal was to have if I was smart, I would have started with purchasing grapes and not planting a vineyard and not trying to build a winery and doing all those ridiculously stupid financial decisions.
Where you spend all that money and you don't see any return for years.
Yeah, and I knew that in theory. Like, I have enough of a business background to realize the financial model is absolutely stupid. But it didn't deter me because that was the point. I wanted to farm. I wanted to get into growing grapes. And I wanted to do it from a place and get good at it in that place and see what that place tells us.
Yeah.
And let that place say, this is, you know what? You might have to rip out those few rows because they're just not ever going to do anything interesting. You might have to replace a little bit here. You'll learn a bit, try a few things. But spend a lifetime doing it. And I knew the property. The soil was great. It's nice, heavy clay. It's got lots of it's the vigor balance is pretty good, more vigorous than I'd expect for clay actually, mm-hmm. but it adds flavor to the wine, it adds depth to the wine and structure to the wine. So
that's the plan, is that eventually it'll just be, you'll be totally independent and
yeah.
won't be relying on and I don't mean that in a bad way, because
no.
so many of the greatest wines or winemakers, they rely on their relationship with their grape growers, where the two sides become simpatico about the philosophy of pruning, of picking, of all those sort of things.
Absolutely. And I don't have one system or approach isn't better than the other.
Yeah.
It was just like, no, I'm not trying to make a lot of wine. I want to make enough wine to have a business that can support itself fundamentally. But the idea is make as the best possible wine we can from the single vineyard, mm-hmm. and come up with some interesting blends. And, you know, I think part of it is we rely in Ontario on these very traditional blending recipes that we've inherited from Europe. And they work great in other places, but we kind of got to wean ourselves off going, okay, here's a Bordeaux blend and we're going to use these three grapes, or a Cab Merlot, whatever, or, you know, the Rhone blend. I think, and I've seen this more recently in the last couple of years for wine, just picking different grapes, especially in the whites. You'll see people throwing whites together and go, that's a fabulous combination. I wouldn't have thought Sauvignon Blanc went with Pinot Gris as well as it does in Prince Edward County, for example, but it's really interesting. And I think that might be more interesting than that $40 Bordeaux blend that they're selling,
right,
for whatever reason. And it's $18 and you're like, so it's again taking that sort of those lenses off from the history and just looking at what you've got growing in the field.
And that'd be harder for some of the reds. Like the idea of a Pinot Noir blend, I don't know if people are going to get behind. I know you get Sangiovese blends. I mean, we get that with Super Tuscans anyway. I like Sangiovese with Bordeaux, with Merlot and Cabernet Sauvignon. But
yeah,
I think we're a little more hesitant with our red blends. I feel with our white blends, we're a little more open-minded than on the other side.
And people tend to just say, oh, look, here's my best wines are probably in barrel, and I'm going to do those as single varietals, and the rest I'm going to throw into a tank and call that my farm blend or something.
Yeah.
And they're willing to take those chances. But I think sometimes the results are actually quite interesting, and we got to pay a little bit more attention to those. But I don't know. I agree with you on the sales side of...
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Blending Pinot Noir with... But maybe that's kind of what we need to do. And there's some great Pinot Noir in Ontario.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. And sometimes, yeah, don't blend it. You've got that barrel, bottle that, because I want to drink it just as is. But if it's not that, maybe it would go really well with something else. I don't know.
Maybe that'll be a place for you. You know. And also, you mentioned Syrahs. Yeah, I think we do great Syrahs. Cassaba, Creekside. There's a lot of good.
Bingo.
A lot of good.
Two of my favorites.
Yeah,
right
there's
there.
A lot of good yeah. Syrahs. Great. I really like the Cassaba Syrah. I got introduced to that last winter. I was like, Jesus.
That's an eye opener when you try those, and you're like, okay, I got to tell people about this.
All right, enough about other people's wine. Tell me a little bit about the 2018 Foxcroft Chardonnay. Is it? Here's the dumb question from the Foxcroft Vineyards. I'm assuming.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Is this single vineyard?
Single vineyard
Foxcroft. Perfect. Yeah. Dumb question by me.
And it's been done many times, and there's some great examples, and you've tried them from others, famous ones. But they're all a little different. They all come from different parcels, and some people know that vineyard so well that they'll pick from specific parts of the vineyard. And this is me getting two rows kind of in the middle and getting two used barrels from Burgundy and just using Cloudsley was the partner and basically made this wine, put it together and press, throw it in a barrel and leave it. So, you know, just let the grapes speak for itself. And I think every vintage is different. Chardonnay is interesting in that it's both very much a terroir wine as per Burgundy, but then again it's a winemaking wine because there's so much winemaking going, choice of barrels, malolactic, when you're picking it, how long you age it for, and if you want to do anything more. So you've altered it a lot. You put a lot of flavors into the wine with those. How you're experiencing it, I haven't got to it yet. How are you feeling about it?
Love it. I love Ontario Chard. I love Foxcroft. Little juicy orange, a little bit of tropical. Just it's an interesting nose, and when I say interesting, I mean a good way. There's a little bit of spice going on, a little bit of peach. It's a really nice nose. It's the butter is there, but the butter is a whisper. Mm. Yeah, this is exactly the sort of Ontario Chardonnay I like. It's full bodied. It's delicious. Mm.
Thanks for that. That's great, and I love your description of it. This wine to me. I won't try to add to your adjectives because I think you did a really good job. There is a tropical note to it, and tropical is not a word I like to associate with Chardonnay. Generally, we're mostly as winemakers thinking I like that kind of leaner French classical. Yeah. Like I'm going to pair this with a great salad niçoise or something kind of a concept.
Yeah. Oh no, tropical. But, it's not like it's when you open up a can of Dole fruit.
No,
and the juice of that. It's
but it's got that seam that makes it interesting. And what I was going to say was that I got derailed from the wine's just coming together now. So this spent 18 months in barrel. This was harvested in October of 18, bottled last June. And for the first year, I almost called it like Chardonnay deconstructed because you could taste the fruit and then you could taste that slightly creamy, buttery.
Yep.
And then you got the barrels on the end. You got a little smoke on the end, and a lot of people said, Taylor, I just love the Chardonnay. And they say, Chardonnay's, and they tell me about how it was made. I said, I can taste how it was made. That's because the pieces were sitting there, but now I'm drinking it today. And I haven't had this in a number of weeks, actually, to be honest with you. And it's coming together like a wine. So this wine, the one thing I thought about this wine from day one is it's got some ageability. It's got some potential.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And that's a sign of a good vineyard. There's a lot going on. You've still got the lime, citrus, But the flavor profile goes all the way through to some, the peach, you've got the stone fruits, and then you've got some kind of these tropical, what was it, you mentioned some
juicy orange.
Orange, good one. Yeah, I've had passion fruit come up. And so you've got that nice spectrum of flavors. It's a great vineyard, and Ontario does Chardonnay very well. I've found a lot of places do Chardonnay quite well. It's a grape that really, I mean, it's the most popular grape in the world because...
It's damn good.
It's damn good. It grows a lot of places well.
Yeah, exactly. It's a fucking great wine. Like it, I always argue, and someone who's been on this podcast, a friend of mine, Emily Pierce, we would debate what's the best grape, and I would always be like, "Well, it's Pinot or maybe Cab or Nebbiolo." You know, I'd be going back and forth, and she's like, "Chardonnay," and I would always fight with her with it. But I think now, because she also though tricked me, because also can be used for champagne.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Yeah, there. Yeah. Well, my line is, if you're going to pick one grape for a deserted island, I'm going to pick Chardonnay. And the reason is, on the hot days, I'm going to have the Chablis. On the super cold days, I'm going to have the Meursault or the Sonoma.
Mm-hmm.
When I want to forget that I'm there, I'll have the Napa. It'll be higher alcohol. And the day I get saved, then it's a vintage Blanc de Blanc.
There you go.
So yeah,
love
so it.
It
runs.
Love
a bit,
it.
But
love it.
Yeah, no, I'm Chard's my favorite of all white.
Cool. I'm glad. I'm glad I brought one over. Glad you enjoy it. And that's a great argument for Chardonnay. I've often put the same argument or a similar argument forward for Chenin Blanc,
which is the perfect
steely dry minerality from one end to. Yeah. Off dry to sparkling to amazing botrytis. And guess what? Mm-hmm. Why don't we have Chenin Blanc ice wines in Ontario?
We should.
So
why don't we have? Wait a minute. We got Côte de Lyon. I mean, like, Christ, we've got it right there.
So I put in a couple rows of Chenin Blanc. Should have left more space, but I put a couple more rows in 19. So I've got it. And and that's one thing. Actually, there's a place beside. I never got around to buying some, but my friends say, go to Cornerstone Taylor. It's right around the corner from me. They have a great Chenin Blanc from years ago. It's still on their shelves. I was reading Carl Kaiser, and there was a book, and Zeraldo did a book on ice wine. They've done a couple books, but I think the one I picked up recently, Carl talks about appropriate grapes for ice wine, and he mentions that one of his, sort of a little footnote in the bottom of the paragraph is, we tried Chenin Blanc a couple times and it was amazing. So anyway.
The great sweet wines of Loire.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Christ, why not? Yeah. And Chenin Blanc's also good for people that love Chardonnay. Because Chardonnay is so much more accessible. It's everywhere. It's every restaurant by the glass program. You're going to find Chardonnay. For people that want to venture out, I often recommend, hey, go to Chenin. You know, because it can have enough of Chardonnay-ish, but Chardonnay qualities, but it's clearly not. But it's a good sort of, okay. Like, you know when you want to attract a cat? You sort of, you know, and he's like, come here. Yeah. And you just slowly, that's kind of Chenin Blanc. It's like, okay, you want to leave Chard? Come over here. Come on. Don't worry. Just come over here. You know, you'll be fine. You'll be fine. Really well put together. Really well integrated. Nothing blousy. Nothing flabby. Because sometimes when you say tropical fruit or this or that,
that's what I'm going.
That's code for.
This is over the top.
Yeah, it's code for flabby tropical fruit. I'm drinking a margarita, but it's a white wine.
This is a great point about the vintage you're hitting on, because you say tropical and you go, okay, this wine too hot, or they didn't pick it right. 18 was a very interesting year because it started off warm, and there was this drought in the middle, got really dry. And then it sort of started to cool down. We got a little bit more rain, cooled down. So this vintage, and I've been sort of saying this about both wines, actually, and I wonder when we get to the cab later whether you agree, but it exhibits a type of ripeness and a type of restraint at the same time. And I think it really follows the weather from that year. I think it's in the wines. I think it's interesting.
Yeah. No, that's lovely. I would absolutely recommend it. It falls within my spectrum. I'm going to be like, I'm a good customer for you for Chard, especially from Foxcroft as someone who buys a ton of like Batchelder and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Paired well with the Parm, the blue cheese.
It did hold up to the Parm. I was impressed.
Yeah. 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 No, it went toe to toe with it.
By the way, folks, Matthew was kind enough to, I brought a couple of wines here, but he's kind enough to make a cheese and Serrano ham plate for us that we're trying to nibble on without getting that in the microphones. And it's, Very kind of you.
Yeah, I know. No worries. And also, for the listeners worried about COVID, they are two separate individual plates with their own individual cheese knives, and we are both sitting at opposite ends of the table.
There's a new language we're going to have with COVID, and we're going to have these little caveats or...
Provisos, caveats.
Clarifications.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because usually before COVID, every interview I did, I would sit on their lap or they would sit on mine. That was how all interviews.
Right.
No, that's the normal way you would, of course, do it. Mm-hmm. Now you got to be far apart. But yeah, I would fully recommend. Hey, before we move on to the next one, how hard is it? And you sort of talked about it. How hard is it just to let the wine be?
Oh, it's hard.
Because when you worked in media, right? You were at the Weather Network as a producer, or in what role were you? When you were doing that job?
I was really in a business management role. I was running the digital business.
Okay, so business management.
Yeah.
So again, you're doing your best to control things. You know, like any manager.
Big time.
Make sure everything runs smoothly. Make sure that everyone is on time. The budget, all the money that is spent is done in a proper, efficient sort of way. Then you go to winemaking, which is like you're out there and... And you've purchased these grapes, but you talked with a grape grower. It's like, okay, I want to do it like this. And okay, we should pick now. And you're doing all the stuff. Mm. And then you put it in the barrel and then it's get out of here. Just
leave it alone, man.
Leave it alone.
I mean, this is where, do you want the wine to taste like the place or do you want it to taste like you?
Yeah.
And just getting yourself out of the way.
Yeah.
And you know, you get into winemaking and for me, it was like, I always thought, okay, I'm cooking now. So I want to do a little addition or I want to do, let's try another vessel or let's rack the wine or let's do something. You always got, but in this case, and Adam Lowy and Matt Smith at Cloudsley are very much of that. Let's call it a little bit of the Back Elder Ontario School of Burgundy and laissez-faire winemaking.
And it should be said, sorry to interrupt, if you want to tell everyone, Cloudsley Cellars.
Yeah.
That's a great producer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, for the listeners who don't know who they are.
Oh, yeah. And they just specialize in Pinot and Chard.
Yep.
That's Adam's thing, and that was his vision, and he's been right behind that, and a great partner. And so they approach this wine really as they approach their Chards, and they produce a Foxcroft Chardonnay as well, which definitely worth checking out, as well as other single vineyard Chards. So, and their philosophy was leave it to the extent that the fermentation on this particular Chardonnay did not finish before the winter time. Mm. And this is a known thing with Foxcroft and it happens. And we left the barrels unsulfured until the spring. And that takes a lot of balls. It takes a lot of, okay, I'm not going to re-inoculate. I'm not going to sulfur it and hope I can start it up again. Or,
fermentation's like a bad, it's like a bad or an old lawnmower where you just, come on. Get started again.
Yeah. Well, and also, we've got to trust the wines a little bit more than we do. I'm generalizing, but human beings, as you said, like to control it and like to make sure things finish on as they're expected to. But you know what? You can leave a wine in barrel unsulfured over the winter. It's not the end of the world. It's happened a lot in Europe for many, many years, people. It's a bit like it gets me on the pasteurized milk thing. It's like, Jesus. You come back to Canada after living in Europe, you're like, we don't have cheese in our grocery stores. It's not really cheese. Why? And I shouldn't get on my milk lobby thing, but like, come on. Like, just let the people make cheese without pasteurizing all the milk all the time. Let's not be so afraid of bacteria. It's going to be okay.
Yes.
It's going to be okay, people. Just relax.
So the Cabernet, first thing I noticed... 13.5% alcohol.
Yep.
Where is the grape sourced for? And again, 85% Cabernet Sauvignon, 15% Cab Franc. Where is this wine from? Like where the grapes? Where they source from?
This is 85% from the Lakeview Vineyard, which is literally across the street from Foxcroft Vineyard on the other side of Nether Wismer Vineyard, across the street on Victoria. Called Lakeview because it looks over the lake. Beautiful, stunning old piece of property, and they've got a few different grape varietals on there. It's not a Cabernet Vineyard. Foxcroft has a number of things on it as well. So it's basically, again, a 20-mile bench wine. The blending agent we found that worked best, and we tried a few Cab Francs. We said, let's just add a little Cab Franc to it. The blending agent that worked best came from Creek Shores, which is just down the road, so not too far away.
Yep. Were you worried about sometimes, like the one thing I noticed, I've only took a quick sip, but only a tiny hint. And by the way, there's nothing wrong with a tiny hint, but there's not what I was there. It doesn't have the green herbaceous. By the way, I should tell, I think I poured a little too much in your glass. I made it difficult to swirl.
Oh, no.
These are the you know.
I've had the wine a few times before, Matthew. It's
yeah.
Okay.
But the first thing I smell for, I'm like, oh, how green is it going to be?
Well, that's it. That's yeah. The question with Ontario Reds. How green was it?
Yeah, not.
It's not green at all.
No. No, you got to really hunt for it. You almost have to be looking for it to find the bell pepperish sort of thing, which some people like. I'm not a fan of the green in maybe the odd Loire Cap Franc, but for the most part, no, I'm not a fan.
I think most people are like that because we're used to plusher, richer things. I think in Cap Franc it's really important. In Cab Sauv, it's not so important because Cab Sauv's got other... I hate to say other things going on, more things going on, but the Cab Franc, I think that's a telltale note. And if it gets too ripe, I think you've left it too long. So you want, in my mind, you want to keep that because that's what tells me it's Cab Franc. That's what makes it interesting.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Individual, but not too much. You don't want to be like, oh my God, I'm chewing on some woody green pepper here or something. No. Mm. So it's the amount that we're talking about. But this was. Don't have the precise. This is picked late October. Not particularly early or late in a not particularly warm year. No, I think we're getting out of the zone, and this is a little bit to climate change, and it's going to help us in one way great and one way a bit sad, but it's helping the Ontario wine industry. I think we can ripen this now.
Climate change is helping. Climate change is helping Cabernet in Ontario dry wine in southern England.
Yeah, exactly.
So I bet I would be fooled on this.
In terms of identifying what it was?
Yeah, if I'm doing a blind.
Yeah. It's not, this is what I keep saying. Don't expect the Cabernet that you've bought elsewhere. This is not this, the thing that you buy with a steak. This is versatile. It could go with
chicken. It's lighter.
It could go with fish. It could go with steak. It could go with barbecue. And to be frank, and I'm not just selling the wine, I love the fact that it's lighter.
It's absolutely lighter. You get the acids there. Mm. I did the acid tests, which is you open your mouth like an idiot and leave it open and just see how much salivation is going on. Dark chocolate notes mixed with red fruit, a little spice. I do get the Cab Franc. There is
a bit of the
herbaceousness thing going on. But in the same way with the Shard, there was some tropical, but it wasn't defined by tropical. I would say... The tropical note that I related to the Shard would be the herbaceous I would relate with this.
So, again, I think there's a vintage thing going on here with these 18s that's really nice that I like. Because you mentioned you went from dark chocolate to red fruits.
Yeah.
And you got that whole spectrum of, oh, my God, how do you get that spectrum of flavors into it? And I think Ontario is great at that. I think Ontario's thing that we've got to really bottle is the aromatics of the wine. It's getting to the edge. Now I'm getting a little bit of leathery stuff on here. That's because it's had a year in bottle. It's actually starting to mature. It's still young.
A little bit of that savory, meaty leather thing. Yeah.
Yeah. A little bit just coming on now. And that'll get nicer and richer as it ages. But a year ago, it was red fruit. I've got strawberries. I've got red cherry. And then you'd leave it in the bottle. And 2 hours later, you'd have a little gust and go, oh my God, you start with strawberries, then you go, I've got cherries and chocolate. Oh my God. Mm-hmm. Fascinating.
Yep. Yeah, like a cherry dipped in chocolate.
So there's a freshness, there's the acidity, the red fruit freshness, and yet there's a riper thing going on. Same as the Chardonnay. I think it's really, really fun.
So this was the wine I was worried about.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
When you were coming here.
Right.
Because I haven't had a lot of good Ontario Cabernet, especially if the blend, once we're getting north of 50%, Lely, back in the day, rest in peace, original Lely ownership, they had some high Cabernet Sauvignon that I'm like, woo, you're good. What's with you? And they pointed out the vineyard. They were like, and this is during my schooling days, they said, you see the vineyard there? I'm like, yeah. I'm like, you see the hills around it? I'm like, yeah. Well, that protects it from the wind.
Yeah.
It's 2 degrees warmer there.
Yep.
And then I'm like, oh, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah. They know their stuff. They're great. And so, I still have a couple of their stuff in the cellar.
Oh, you lucky.
I have just like one or two left.
I have none.
I opened a, what they called an impromptu, I opened 2000 impromptu which is a Syrah-based blend, I believe, about last winter. Anyways, I posted on Instagram about it because I was like, this wine, Derek Barnett, this wine needs...
Yeah.
This wine is still young. It hadn't even really... It was like midway through its evolution. It's like, how did they do that? Great. Yeah. Some great stuff there.
Yeah. I keep trying to get a hold of Derek Barnett for the pod. Anyway, so I love the smell on it. And I'm like, okay. Mm. Oh, good.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good. And then I had the first sip. And I'm like, okay. It's fresh. I like the acid. It's not heavy. And I'm like, okay. It's good. It's good. And then I'm like, okay, let's give it time. Let's let it swirl.
Right.
And then by the third sip, I'm like, all right, now I'm enjoying you.
Right.
Like it went from, okay, no, it's good. Like I'm like, okay, this is a well-made wine.
Right.
But yeah, much like I told the good people of Henry of Pelham, I'm like, this is an excellent made Baco Noir.
Doesn't mean I love it.
But I'm not going to buy it. I'm like, I'm like, people should buy it.
Right.
I'm not going to buy it. But I love Henry of Pelham. Christ, like so much of their, but this one. Yep. After, the meaty notes are there.
It grows on you. It's, again,
exactly.
Ontario wines, this is a terrible metaphor, but it's in my head from some old movie. It's a grower, not a shower.
Yep.
But they don't grab you by the pants and say, look at me. You kind of drink them, and then you go, oh, there's actually a lot going on here.
Mm-hmm.
I love the versatility of this wine.
Yes.
And do you know what? As a wine lover, you don't bash other wine regions, but I'm just a little bit less excited about heavy Cabernets. I need something a little bit fresher, a little bit more food friendly, something that I'm going to enjoy more than a glass and a half of.
Yes.
And that's going to open up over time, turn into something different, take me on a little journey. And that's what a nice little wine is all about.
100%. I think the philosophy is a lot of winemakers or wine consignment company people like Pierce Pretham, when I'm talking with them, is, you know, they want a wine where after the first glass, you want that second one.
Yeah.
You don't want the fatigue. You don't want to have the glass of some big, powerful Amarone, and you're like, oh God, okay, I'm done.
And I think the wine audience is changing that way. We've been through that. And Australia's changed. Australians reined it in. You see their wines today, they're better. And they're fresher. And, you know, we're not trying to make Coca-Cola syrup anymore. And lots of younger people see that. And that's what they're going for, something different. So that's I think we can say that's happened pretty much.
Oh, yeah. I see it more and more. Like, I think in the late 90s to the early 2000s, power, 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 power. Big, powerful, bold. Get you. Grab a hold of you.
Yeah.
It'll wrestle you. It'll power slam you.
Yeah.
And then slowly, and I'm not going to do the thing where I'm going to shit all over Robert Parker. I mean, you know, part of it is just adjusting to his taste, and everyone's got their taste, and things adapt, things change.
And it's now it's part of the context of the times, as you're saying.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And now freshness and acidity are so much more important now than they were 20 years. And that was a long time ago, than it was 20 years ago.
And frankly, Ontario, here's the part about global warming I'm worried about. Great, we can ripen Cabernet now.
Yeah.
Worried about the acids.
Yes.
I don't know if we can really call ourselves a cool climate. I think that term is bandied around a lot. But, okay, if you can't ripen Cabernet Sauvignon reliably, are you cool climate? Not sure that's the definition. But,
yeah.
But, you know.
I always, like, well, for me, I mean, just in the spectrum of wine, not in the impact that climate change has on the environment, on third world nations, all that kind of all the important heady stuff that you're not listening to this podcast for anyway, because quite frankly, I'm not smart enough for that. From the wine perspective, my biggest concern is always, what is climate change going to do to my Chateauneuf-du-Pape? What's it going to do to my southern Rhone, my northern Rhone? What's it going to do to, what is it going to do
Burgundies.
To my... Thank you.
Your Burgundies,
Do not, climate change, do not go near my Chambord Moussigny. Do not go near my Volnay.
Because the Bordeaux can handle it, and you can pick it appropriately.
Exactly.
The Pinots could get slaughtered.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I don't, when I want my bigger, heavier Burgundy, great, there's my Chambertin. Come on over here. But even those ones are still needing to be elegant. But yeah, that's my big concern about climate change.
100%.
From a wine perspective, 100%. Only from a wine perspective.
And we all love France, and you know what? also Tuscany. These places are getting hot, hot,
yes.
hot. And you know what? Love Brunello's as just one example. But don't want them all to be 14.5%, 15%. Sorry. I don't.
When you buy wine, how much, like, I find now when I'm looking at wine, when I see 15%.
Yeah, I just steer away. Yeah.
I'm only going there if I've tried it before at 15% and I know it's still, still has enough acid to it. Like, and when I'm having my cab, I don't need it to be Pinot. I don't want it to be Pinot. I want it to be cab. I don't have a bigger, bolder. I want that. I'm not anti-bold.
Right.
I'm just anti early palate fatigue where I feel like I'm that this wine is a slog.
It's a fine line.
Yeah.
It's a fine line.
It's hard.
And that's what winemaking gets down to. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm always impressed with especially the California winemakers that are making the California wine that are still sticking with finesse and, or trying, not finesse, still trying to have enough freshness in it. I'm always impressed with those that can do it.
Yeah, it's a tough thing to nail down. It's just, as you, and I think you said it before, it's a matter of the wine still being delightful, still being enticing, still making you come towards it, want more, drawing you in. Mm-hmm. Having more to say. The problem with heat is actually it's cooking the flavors. It's not just the heaviness. The flavors are starting to go.
Yeah.
And the other big thing is the terroir specificity. So that's too academic sounding word, but what happens is all wines start to taste the same. At a 90 degree summer for 3 months, all red wines start to eventually will just taste like the same red wine.
Yeah.
When they're overripe, they just lose their varietal characteristic. That's a better way of saying what I'm trying to say.
And there's nothing worse than ordering a glass of Cabernet. It's like, what did it taste like? It just tastes like red juice with booze. Mm-hmm. I want it's like anything else. I want my Grenache, my Merlot, my Pinot, my Cab. I want them to taste what they're supposed to taste like.
You got it.
Yeah. This is great.
Glad you're enjoying it, Matt.
Yeah. Well, we got a couple of minutes left. Just a little bit about, now you hired an assistant winemaker.
No, I've hired a full winemaker.
Full wine. Okay. So give a little plug.
And Jonathan McLean, bunch of many years experience in the Okanagan, grew up in Ontario, schooled in Brock, went to the Okanagan, worked for Le Vieux Pin, Stella, Colmena are his most recent ones, which are all, and he's introduced me, he's educated me in the last few months on Okanagan wines and what they've done. And there's some absolutely lovely stuff out there.
Oh, yeah.
I had not spent enough time understanding. And I spoke to John. I've known John for a number of years. And 5 years ago, he said, no, I'm not moving back to Ontario. More personal reasons that brought him back here than my project, although I like to think the project was part of it.
At least part of it.
He some great experience, and the tough decision for me was I kind of got into it wanting to be a winemaker, and I still consider myself to have, you know, some training in it and some experience, but I also realized this thing is about having a really experienced winemaker and somebody who just knows what to do much bigger level than I do, and I always hire somebody who's smarter than you, and that's what it is.
Good for you.
And so John's going to be wonderful. You have to have, it's a very personal relationship, especially when you're like a cook yourself and you hire another cook to do your cooking. It's a very personal thing and you guys have to see eye to eye. And we just always hit it off. We have the same, very similar sort of palate, direction, vision. And I learn a bunch from him all the time, and he's going to make some incredible wines. And I'm going to learn a hell of a lot. So it's just a win-win. It's going to be great.
I mean, that shows just the proper level of humility, of ego management, and also just securing yourself to be able to go, okay, I'm good at this. Wait, you're better?
Yeah.
And you can help me and I can help you? Great. Come on board and let's do it together. I mean, that's really what you want. That's a good level tailor of maturity on your part.
It really is about the wine. It's, you know, this, and the problem with the wineries, it turns into such a, it's been described to me as the ultimate ego project, but it really wasn't that for me. First of all, I'm not
either loaded with cash to, you know, build some big winery or fancy thing.
John Shangri-La.
You could find me almost any day of the year last summer, the summer before that, picking weeds with my own hands. I mean, it's just, I like to get in there. I like to get dirty. It's not a fancy operation. And come on by and we'll show you the farm, so to speak. But it's all about the wine. We just want to make really great wine. And to some extent, this is the really tricky part about the wine thing, because it is a business. You can plant two rows of grapes and you realize it's too expensive to be a hobby. So it's got to be a business. But you kind of got to manage the business side of it. When the business takes over the property and it's all business, then the wine, I have a
sense. The wine suffers.
My little idealistic mind says the wine's going to suffer.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to carve that fine line. This is my, you know, personal speaking, is trying to carve that line between really focusing on the winemaking and the wine and the product and local, and just letting the grapes show us the way. Tell us what you want to become. Tell us what you're going to grow up to be like. And we'll do whatever we can to get you out there and tell the world that you're as good as everybody else in the world and you deserve as much attention as everything else out there. Like a child, like all of us, like all beings, like animals, everything. And then sort of managing and going, I don't want to be in a position in 15 years where I have to go from 3,000 cases to 8,000 cases just to break even. It might very well happen, and there's nothing I can do about it. Who knows? But that's where we are now.
Well, in the end, it's same thing with trying to get that balance, that line of power versus freshness with your cab. Just the overall philosophy is, how do I make wine that I believe in, that is honest to the terroir?
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, I'm making enough of a profit to survive to make the next vintage.
You'd be crazy to think you're going to make a lot of money doing this.
You're never going to make a ton of money.
Absolutely crazy.
All you want to do is be happy with the job and be just slightly in the black. If you can do that, then you've got what you want. Hey, as we end this, Taylor, where can people find you? Where, website, phone number, address, email?
Oh, yeah.
Sure. If people want to get Black Bank Hill, and again,
yeah.
The Chardonnay is fantastic. And for people looking for a red wine with just, there's the flavor, the aromatics, there's a freshness there. It ain't a heavy cab. It's I can see why
Ontario cab.
Yeah. If you want to try an Ontario Cabernet that won't scare you.
Versatile.
Yeah. Goes
with everything.
Yeah, so where can they find you?
www.blackbankhill.com is our home base. Mm-hmm.
Easy, by the way, easy website, easy to remember.
Yeah, we kept it
simple. Blackbankhill.com.
Kept it simple, and I'm Taylor at blackbankhill.com. Mm-hmm. And you want to call me, give me a call, 647-562-7442.
What's that number one more time? Now I'm going to get my radio. What's that number one more time?
647-562-7442. Call anytime, day or night. I'll be there waiting for your call.
Thanks so much, Taylor.
Thanks, Matthew.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Stitcher, Spotify, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.